So whatever the message GOP leadership wants to put forth, moves by the party, especially in southern states, have made gaining traction nationwide more difficult. That, according to Farrell Guillory, a professor at the University of North Carolina, who spoke to Morning Edition's Bob Oakes this morning.
Republicans are passing laws that threaten to restrict voters and have enacted full-throated Republican conservative agenda. The question is whether the Republican Party is too Southern for its own good.
So we're going to begin our week in review, regular week in review segment with this effort by the Republican Party. And joining us now are two members of our week in review A-team, Peter Kanellos, editorial page editor for the Boston Globe. And happy Friday, Peter, and welcome to you.
Thank you, Anthony.
Also with us, former federal judge and Harvard Law School professor Nancy Gertner. Nancy, good to have you back. Thanks so much for making the trip in.
Good to be here.
So, Peter, you heard that interview with New Hampshire Representative Garcia, and you've been following the RNC meeting in Boston. First of all, what's the significance of having this annual meeting here in Boston?
I think the RNC is serious about wanting to address this issue. I think that there is a very symbolic significance in having the meeting in Boston because their party in Boston is probably weaker than anywhere else in the country. And there's no doubt that they want to find some solution to the declining support among minorities. I did think the interview that we just heard was much more on the propaganda side of things than the actual kind of heavy inward-looking thinking that Republican Party has to do. Because it's simply not true what the representative said, that both parties are working hard on immigration reform. That's the kind of the Republican cover line. But the House is, opposed adamantly to a very moderate bipartisan bill that came out of the Senate. The Republicans in the House are opposed to it and are blocking it with every procedural maneuver that they can. So I don't think that they're going to have success raising that Hispanic support if they're going to be taking an extreme measure against a popular comprehensive reform bill that's before them right now.
Mm. Nancy, what do you think? We heard that interview with Representative Garcia. Respond to what Peter says. I mean, what's your view on how effective this effort by the GOP can be in sort of reshaping support for this party?
What comes to mind, and it may be because I'm not used to political commentary, having been a judge, is rearranging the deck chairs on the Titanic. That just resonates. I agree with him completely that when you ask the representative what were the meaningful changes to deal with meaningful concerns of the electorate, she said essentially, I don't think it's a matter of policy. I think it's a matter of who the spokesperson is. And of course, that's not true. It is a matter of policy.
But maybe it's a matter of both, Peter. I mean, you do need messengers that are going to sort of represent certain communities, but you also need the policy, right?
I think that's true. I think what we saw, though, in 2012 was that the messengers, at least the speakers that were put forward at the Republican National Convention, were actually quite diverse. So the Republican Party has a diverse group of candidates coming up in Nikki Haley and Bobby Jindal and Marco Rubio and people like that, you know, people of color coming up in the Republican Party, not really African-Americans, but other minorities. But the convention itself was so 100% white, at least as far as the eye could see on television, that it presented this jarring, you know, sense to readers at home or viewers at home that this wasn't the real America in the Republican Party. And so they need to address it on a grassroots level in addition to finding the right candidate spokesman to put on the podium.
It seems like the broader challenge, too, is this internal division in the Republican Party between hardline Tea Party types and more traditional moderates in the Republican Party. And given that division, Nancy, it seems like putting together this winning coalition that also poses a big challenge.
Putting together a coalition that bridges the gap between those two constituencies, mm-hmm. yes, is a challenge, particularly since the right has gone further right than ever before. It was one thing when everyone was sort of sloshing around in the middle right, middle. But these are really stark kinds of changes, and it's very stark diversions, rather, in the party. And it's very hard to figure out how they will cross those divides.
Well, let's move on to this week's big story, which, of course, came on Monday. After 5 days of deliberation, a jury found Boston mobster James Whitey Bulger guilty of 31 of 32 counts of extortion, money laundering, weapons charges, and racketeering, including involvement in numerous murders. The outcome of the trial was never much in doubt, yet the verdict was a watershed in the decades-long Bulger saga of crime, FBI corruption, and a notorious mobster finally brought to justice. Federal prosecutors praised the outcome, and curiously, so did Bulger's attorney, J.W. Carney.
It was important to him that the government corruption be exposed, and important to him that people see firsthand the deals that the government was able to make with certain people. With that as what he was looking for from a trial, he's very pleased.
So he's very pleased. So, Nancy, this trial, sometimes it seemed to stray into sort of an alternative universe sometimes. And the idea that Bulger, who will spend the rest of his days in prison, was pleased by this trial for exposing government corruption seemed to be an example of that. But your thoughts?
Well, it was clear that Mr. Bulger was not going to go softly into the night after he was arrested. And he had a right to a trial to be sure that most of the many of the charges he had already admitted to, and those would have been charges even if he had not been convicted of anything else that would lead to could lead to life imprisonment. So this was for him an opportunity to try to say what he wanted to say. And I do think, I mean, the prosecutor should be praised. I think Jay Carney needs to be praised. But I do want to sort of roll back the clock for a moment. Mm. It's one thing if you start telling the story about the prosecution of James Whitey Bulger just about a year ago, you miss most of the story. The story began when Judge Wolf carried the U.S. Attorney's Office kicking and scratching to uncover this corruption. So the serious, it seems to me, the serious takeaway here is how do we make sure that the system self-corrects without extraordinary acts on the part of Judge Wolf, without extraordinary investigations? How do we make sure this doesn't happen again, this being essentially a confidential informant program in which we rewarded murderers?
Mm. And Peter, Nancy raises one of the central themes in this whole story, and a lot of folks have lamented that the full story of government corruption and complicity in the Bulger years was not fully exposed. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, I think it's difficult to have two trials at once. You know, there's Whitey on trial and have the FBI trial at the same time. And the initial push by Whitey Bulger to claim that the FBI had given him immunity and had put him up to it was a little bit confusing and ridiculous on its face, because even if some corrupt agent had said, okay, we're going to look the other way if you commit a murder, no right-thinking person could ever believe that that's a carte blanche to go out and commit murder. You know, mm-hmm. So Whitey is guilty of those crimes, whether or not the FBI was corrupt. There needs to be, as Nancy suggests, a much deeper reckoning within the government over the FBI and what happened here. And I know that the sentiments of the FBI leaders are certainly correct. What they've been saying about this being the worst scandal in the department's history are appropriate. But there needs to be some serious internal examination as well.
Mm, well, let's hope that comes. But let me ask you both about this jury and how they performed. This was an exceedingly long and complicated and challenging case. They deliberated for 5 days. Yesterday, our own Deb Becker talked to Marissa Petrarca. She's a 29-year-old from Brighton who served on the jury and who expressed a lot of pride in what she and her fellow jurors did.
It's a jury of your peers. And if that were me on trial, I would want the 12 of us, because we were very careful and we took it seriously. That was the silver lining in all of the horrible things that we saw and learned about.
So, Nancy, I want to ask you in particular as a former judge. You know, I found this interview really fascinating because it really provided a wonderfully articulate insight into what went on in that jury room. And what are your thoughts on how this jury managed this case, from what we can understand?
Well, I thought it was very impressive. Whereas everyone was expecting a verdict within seconds because of the press coverage of this. This is a jury that, notwithstanding what the pressures were, wanted to go through the judge's instructions and go through it verdict line by verdict line. I used to interview jurors after trials, and it is a very, very impressive system. I might add, though, that the government could have chosen a more simple presentation. It could have gone with its best shot again, bearing in mind that many of the counts independently would produce a life sentence or could produce a life sentence. But it I think, chose to surface the things that the community wanted to have surfaced and do it in this setting, by the way, in ways that they had not done in the various civil cases that had come out of the Bulger years, where the government had been determined to oppose anyone recovering any money. But it was their choice to make it complicated, and to the credit of this jury, they went through those counts one by one.
Well, let's just look forward really quickly, because now comes an appeal that would be based on this notion that Bulger couldn't present the case that he wanted to, that is, that he'd been granted immunity for his crimes by the government. Peter, what's interesting to you about how this next chapter will play out?
Well, I hope that it plays out more quietly and sort of legalistically, because I actually agree with what the judge said. I mean, I certainly agree with what the judge said about the government choosing to make a presentation that the community wanted to hear. And it was more complicated, perhaps, than it needed to be legally. But I think that the community, the people of Boston, got to hear the whole story through the parade of Bulger Confederates that came up there, and they can make their own judgment about whether people were influenced by their plea deals or not. But it was fascinating to the entire community to see the inner workings of the Bulger gang play out as fully as they got to see. And it was an easy-to-digest, well-presented case. And that's what's most important here. It's not the technical legal side of things. I mean, my strong presumption is that the appeal will go uneventfully and that Bulger's conviction will be affirmed. But, you know, from here on out, we could do with a little less Whitey Bulger in this town.
Here, here. Well, on that note, let's move on to another big story, a national story, really, but that will have an impact in all 50 states, including here in Massachusetts. Faced with massive prison overcrowding, U.S. Attorney General Eric Holder called for easing up on harsh sentences for certain drug-related crimes. He wants to change the way Justice Department policy so that low-level nonviolent drug offenders will not be subjected to mandatory minimum prison sentences. And he told the American Bar Association this week that too many Americans are in too many prisons for too long.
And with an outsized, unnecessarily large prison population, we need to ensure that incarceration is used to punish, to deter, and to rehabilitate, but not merely to warehouse and to forget.
So, Nancy, the so-called war on drugs dates back to the 1980s. How significant is this shift?
It is significant that the chief law enforcement officer in the country is saying that. Hmm. It is sort of a necessary but not sufficient condition to actually changing things. It will take people don't understand that Attorney General Holder actually doesn't have direct line control over all of the U.S. attorneys in the country. So it's going to take a quantum leap in the way that they look at their job. Mm. I saw many a nonviolent offender being charged with a mandatory minimum because the government represented to me that they knew that this guy was involved with more stuff than they were telling me or than they could prove. Okay. And I would say to them, this court is not about trust me. You have the goods or you don't. But the availability of mandatory minimums enabled them to get onerous sentences for people that they believed were involved in other activities. So it's going to take more than the Attorney General. It'll take individual U.S. attorneys. It's going to take Congress. It's going to take the Sentencing Commission. This is a boat, the Queen Elizabeth, that needs a lot of players to turn around.
So it's not as simple as he's changed this policy and judges like you or former, you know, judges who are sitting on the bench today are just, boom, they've got a new set of, they've got sort of new latitude in the way they hand out sentences. Not that simple?
It's not that simple because the mandatory minimums were essentially a tool of the prosecutors to get people to cooperate.
I see.
You could take someone that you thought were involved in, was involved in some nasty business, and if you threatened a mandatory minimum, you could get him to cooperate. The problem was sometimes the people were so low down that they didn't have anything to offer, and then they would wind up with that sentence. So you have to do something about the incentives for individual prosecutors across the country and to incentivize the bench and Congress. As someone described it, this is America's failed experiment in mass incarceration, and it's going to take more than Eric Holder to turn it around.
And Peter, you know, I want to come to you on this. How might this affect policies at the state level? I mean, I was reading, according to one survey by the Sentencing Project, 58% of state drug offenders are nonviolent. You know, picking up on what Nancy said, will this shift in federal policy influence state policymakers? And if so, how?
Well, actually, I think the states have actually been a little out ahead of the federal government in terms of dealing with mandatory minimums, including Massachusetts, but also even some very conservative states have moved to alternative sentencing for nonviolent offenders. And it's very noteworthy to me that this has not, Holder's remarks, has not created any sort of a law and order backlash among conservatives. Sometime, I guess, when people weren't looking, conservatives became a little more concerned about mandatory minimums and libertarians sort of got a greater say in the conservative movement. And it speaks well for our ability to craft a sensible policy that liberals, conservatives, moderates, libertarians are all finding problems with mandatory minimums and are willing to work on creative solutions.
Well, let me ask you both quickly about one more story from the legal world this week. Federal court judge Joseph Toro announced this week that he'll retire. Four decades on the Massachusetts bench. He announced his retirement this week on his 83rd birthday. Long, distinguished career, perhaps best known as the judge to first strike down the Federal Defense of Marriage Act. That decision was a bit of a milestone and well ahead of this year's Supreme Court decision that did away with DOMA. So, Nancy, tell us something about Judge Toro.
First of all, he's not retiring. He's taking senior status, which means he can take a reduced load if he chooses.
I see.
This is a judge who was one of my models, and I suspect of many of the other judges on the federal bench, compassion, intelligence, and guts. That's a wonderful winning combination. He is a judge. He was appointed by a Republican who nevertheless believed that it was important to mix strict legal analysis with what the president describes as empathy. So the DOMA decision was not his first major decision. He was responsible for fixing up and cleaning up the Fernald School and dealing with mentally disadvantaged people. I remember an example when I was a lawyer in the 70s where he entered an injunction to stop the tearing down of buildings in the North End. He was largely responsible for the park that we now see in Boston's North End. He was, as I said, it was judgment, and people somehow believe that judges are, you know, machines, but it was judgment, intelligence, compassion, leavened with a huge amount of guts.
Peter, your paper ran a really nice profile of him this week, and in the piece, it quoted Judge Toro as saying that his experience growing up in World War II as a second-generation Italian-American made him sensitive to bigotry. There was a nice quote where he said, "I'm very empathetic to those who insist that they be treated equally." Your thoughts about Judge Toro?
Well, I think Judge Toro was a model judge for Massachusetts and deserves all the accolades that he's been getting. Even though he's 83, I think that he sets a good precedent for judges taking senior status and allowing new judges to be appointed to the Massachusetts Court. Obviously, Judge Gertner retired early, and Judge Wolf, who we mentioned earlier, has taken senior status.
Right. I'm considerably younger.
And you're considerably younger. You're
just
way
wanted to
younger.
Make that clear.
We'll make that very clear.
Right.
Well, but I think it's actually a good precedent for federal judges who have a lifetime appointment to consider a post-judicial career if they would choose one, as Judge Gertner has, but also to consider senior status at a relatively young age, as Judge Wolf did. But even in Judge Torres' case, by all accounts, he's in good health. But, you know, he's reached an age where he really should be taking senior status, and he has done so. Many of his colleagues in the past have hung on for far longer. So I think that's a good thing for Massachusetts that we're going to get some new judges in.
Well, Peter and Nancy, let's move on to our hubbub. Finally, we have just enough time for those little stories perhaps that fell below the fold. And Nancy, let me come to you for your hubbub this week. What's on your mind?
Well, Kevin Cullen's column sort of preempted me, but I wanted to give a shout out to Eddie Burke, who was a court security officer I got to know every day going into the court. Eddie was fought in the Vietnam War, was filled with shrapnel as a result of that, got two Purple Hearts, was exposed to Agent Orange, and decided not only that that service was not enough for him, he then continued his service in working for cancer research, in volunteering on the front line of the Boston Marathon, and better yet, getting along with my husband, an ACLU lawyer, which was itself remarkable given his background. So this his retirement makes me sad, but this is really a jewel of a man.
So another retirement there. Peter Canellis, your hubbub.
Since this is the law enforcement edition of Radio Boston, I was thinking we could talk about the daffodils along the route of the Boston Marathon to honor the victims of the Boston Marathon bombing. This is not strictly law enforcement, but it's a wonderful, humane way to celebrate the marathon, to celebrate the marathon route, and to remember the victims and memorialize people by having daffodils planted. It's going to cost about $20,000, but it would be great if average people contributed the money to make that happen.
Really nice idea. All right, well, so here's my hubbub. There's a little bit of a soundtrack to go along with it. Here it is. All right, so we're listening to Debussy's Clair de Lune. And in case you missed the news this week, the famous Waltham-based piano maker Steinway & Sons is being sold. The price, $512 million. But more surprising, perhaps, than the price is who the buyer is. It's being sold to a hedge fund manager, John Paulson, who's apparently very bullish on the future of the great piano maker. He said the price reflects the attractive value of the company's heritage and growth opportunities. Right after he announced that, shares soared 8% this week, so maybe he's right. And he says that he fully intends to maintain the superb quality of Steinway pianos. So there it is, Steinway & Sons, founded in 1853 when Franklin Pierce was president, sold in 2013 to a hedge fund owner. And let's hope that the music plays on. So that's my hubbub. Peter Canellos, editorial page editor for the Boston Globe, thank you so much for joining us. Have a great weekend.
Thank you, Anthony.
And Nancy Gertner, Harvard Law professor and former federal judge. Nancy, thank you. Have a great weekend.
Thank you.
And listeners, stay with us. Coming up, how shark sightings off the coast of Cape Cod may actually be good for business. I'm Anthony Brooks. This is Radio Boston.